Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey has a lot of irons in the fire. And today on Radio Boston, we are going to talk about them. I'm Tiziana Deering. Welcome to the show. From pushing for a vaccine mandate for public employees to calling for new hate crime legislation, she's got a lot going on. She joins us now. Listeners, she will take your calls. If you have a question for AG Healey, the number is 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Attorney General Healey, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hey, great to be with you, Tiziana. Nice to be on. I look forward to getting back in the studio someday, I have to say.
Me too. So let's just dive in right there, because last time we talked to you was in February. We were still far apart then. A few months is an eternity in pandemic time. What's changed for you since then, and what are you most hankering to get back to?
I think, like a lot of people, I just miss being able to go out, you know, go to the movies, go shopping, go to stores. I mean, we're doing some of that now, and that's good. Things have improved some, but you know, I think that most of us just don't feel entirely the freedom or the safety yet. I miss the human interaction so much. You know, we've worked really seamlessly remotely from home. And I'm so grateful to my team for their resilience and productivity. But, you know, there's nothing like being around the corner from somebody or walking next door to somebody's office or, you know, out and about in the communities. I've been out and about some in recent weeks. I felt it was safer. And boy, it was just really great to be able to see people and connect with people. So, you know, that's, I really miss those kinds of things. It's been a learning experience for all of us. I miss hanging out with friends and family. And I guess, you know, here we are at another Mother's Day, and huge shout out to all the moms out there. I hope that you are celebrated this weekend, as you should be celebrated every day. But, you know, I think that for so many moms, this year has been so incredibly difficult. And I just, you know, want to give a shout out to all the moms out there and the dads too, of course. Best wishes for a happy Mother's Day. And, you know, I look forward to the time when we can actually have birthday parties and Mother's Day celebrations and, you know, barbecues all together again.
And by the way, I appreciate you giving a shout out to the dads, but they get their day. We'll stick with the moms for this week.
Okay.
All right. So let's dive in on policy. There's a lot for us to talk about. And, you know, I think probably the most controversial policy position you've taken of late is support for a vaccine mandate for public employees. Here in the Commonwealth, we're one of the highest ranked states in the nation in the rate of vaccination. So why not wait and see where we end up before calling for this kind of mandate?
It's funny. I don't know that it's all that controversial in the sense that, you know, it's about public health. I think the understanding is, and certainly the science and the CDC tell us, you know, we're all in this together. Frankly, that's why I think we see such concern about what's happening elsewhere in the world and the ability of other countries to get access to the vaccine. So, you know, I just approach it from a perspective of public health. It is true that here in Massachusetts, we have the lowest vaccine hesitancy rate right now. We have high vaccination rates, and we should keep it up. I think we need to continue to focus around access and equity because there are still some people who haven't received the vaccine, a vaccine that we know is free, it's safe, it's effective, and readily available. But the big picture here, just to step back, is really just, you know, public health and what do we need to do to get to where we need to be so that we actually can fully reopen and return to sort of normal life as we know it. And so, you know, to that end, my view is, you know, those of us who are interacting with the public as part of our jobs on a daily basis, whether we're in public health or public safety, you really should be vaccinated to protect your coworkers, to protect yourselves, to protect the residents too, that you serve from further risk of the virus. And obviously, you know, these are hard calls, I think, for a lot of employers and in a lot of sectors, something we're going to be talking about over the next few months. And fortunately, I think the FDA will soon lift the emergency authorization use and approve it once and for all.
Okay, so let's stop there for a second.
That's sort of the operating principle here. It's about how do we best protect public health and prevent the spread of this virus.
So two things. One, I'm going to go to a call on this in a second, but because you talked about the FDA approval, why not at least wait for this conversation until it is fully approved by the FDA instead of authorized for emergency use?
Well, maybe we should, Tatiana. I mean, I don't purport to be the expert here. I just, again, I'm speaking as a matter of common sense, whether you've got public safety workers or corrections officers or police officers, firefighters, whether you've got, you know, folks in my office. I mean, we're still remote right now, but I just think, you know, I had another conversation, you know, earlier about healthcare, right? People who are actually in hospitals and in healthcare systems caring for patients who have an expectation that they're not going to get sick or contract COVID going into a hospital. So, you know, I think it's that approach. And, you know, it's just my personal belief that this is something that is really important to do. I think about all that's happened over the last year plus, and the devastation, the number of people who've died in this state, the number of people who have become very sick in this state, the worry, the heartache, the strain on so many. And, you know, to me, it is about kind of a team mentality, and let's all, you know, pitch in and do our part here, just like the president says.
Let's take a call on this, 800-423-8255. We've got Jim on the line. Now, interestingly, Jim's in Chester, New Hampshire. But Jim, go ahead with your question for Attorney General Maura Healey.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I live in New Hampshire. I work for a public works department in Massachusetts. I've been there 7 years. And I love my job. I plan to retire from there. But I would just like to know what gives somebody the right, especially the Attorney General, to tell me to put something that's medical inside my body that I do not believe in. Otherwise, I'm going to lose my job. I am absolutely flabbergasted at this.
Hey, Jim. Nice to talk to you. I grew up in New Hampshire. Live free or die. You're up in Chester. I grew up down by the beach.
Okay.
You know, first of all, let me be clear with you, Jim. The normal accommodations that exist under the law, if you have a sincerely held religious belief or a disability, there are absolutely legal exemptions to anything. I also, you know, will say that there are any number of instances where we require and mandate certain things, whether it's flu shots or Hep B shots and the like. Again, I'm speaking to you work for a DPW, you know, ultimately it's going to be up to your municipal employer there. But I do wish you the best and wish you well. And, you know, I just encourage people, there is some vax hesitancy out there that's real. I understand that, particularly among communities of color, given the history there. And it is really important. I encouraging people, talk to your healthcare provider. You know, don't trust me. Talk to your healthcare provider about this and just make sure that, you know, you're getting accurate information. We've unfortunately seen some really horrible misinformation on the internet. And that's just, you know, and unfortunately there's some people who are just believing it. But talk to the medical experts. And, you know, again, I just hope that everybody takes care and the sooner we do, you know, the sooner we'll be back to business.
So could we achieve a level of immunity among the population that would obviate the need to have a vaccine mandate for public employees?
I don't know. And I think that it's kind of a pretty discreet question. I think that it kind of misses a little bit of the big picture here. The big picture here is we need to get as many people vaccinated as quickly as possible. I think that's what we've heard from the CDC. It's what we've heard from the president.
But the big picture here, too, is mandating that versus allowing people to do it voluntarily. I do think we need to hold both of those pieces in this big picture.
Well, that's okay. And again, I think I've answered the question about, you know, where I think it's appropriate to require things. Again, people who are working, interacting directly with the public, you know, I think that that's common sense to have that done. I think that when it comes to herd immunity, there's a lot of debate about that. I mean, last night on the news, we were hearing some conflicting reports about you know, sort of what it would take. But I think what I understand is that there's a spectrum, and, you know, the more people who get vaccinated, the fewer hospitalizations we're going to see, the fewer spreads and mutations of a variant we're going to see, and importantly, the fewer deaths we're going to see. So, you know, I think we've all got to operate with that perspective in mind.
Let's take one more call on this before we go on to some other subjects. We've got David on the line in Lexington. David, go ahead.
Hi, thank you. I'm so very grateful that Attorney General Healey is taking this position. I do think there are some pros and cons, and I understand, and I'm grateful that she responded in such a compassionate manner to the previous caller. I understand his concerns, but I think on balance, and there's so much information out there. If you want to understand what makes sense, the information is out there now, and you can, you know, the true accurate information. The only thing I would say is I wonder if it's possible to take those state employees who don't choose to get vaccinated and at the very minimum put them on unemployment, not just plain fire them, you know, and on some kind of furlough where they could come back if they decide to get vaccinated.
Thanks for that,
David.
David,
appreciate
go ahead,
your call. And let me be clear. I am not calling for the firing of anyone. The question was simply, you know, I think further to comments that I made a couple weeks ago about the importance, in my view, of ensuring that those who are interacting with the public are protected for the sake of their coworkers and for the sake of the public that they serve, right? That the taxpayers pay to serve the public. And, you know, this is about mitigating risk of exposure. So, you know, hopefully, you know, we never in our employment settings even get to these discussions, right? Get to these hypotheticals. My point is just one to encourage, you know, vaccinations, get the information, as you say. I think that we have learned a lot over the last year through studies about efficacy, effectiveness, effects, you know, and I just would continue to encourage people to get the information by talking to their healthcare providers.
So let's shift gears. We've got some other things I'd love to have time to touch on. Let's talk about the Hinton Lab. So Middlesex and Suffolk District Attorneys Marion Ryan, Rachel Rollins are both pursuing vacating up to thousands of convictions that were based on drug testing done by chemists Sonia Farrick and Annie Dukin. Middlesex County District Attorney Marion Ryan, for example, is requesting the SJC vacate cases beyond her own jurisdiction. I know you know Suffolk County DA Rachel Rollins has launched her own Hinton Lab initiative. Do you support this type of systemic, or as Rachel Rollins has called it, global resolution for these cases?
Oh, I have, and I've advocated for that for the last several years. You know, I think it's incredibly important, and we all agree that Dukin and Farrakh's crimes were egregious. They undermine the integrity of our justice system. The impact of these cases are going to have implications for many years to come. Tens of thousands of people's lives have been affected in many ways. And, you know, that started with the misconduct of the labs by Dukin and Farrakh. And I have been focused as Attorney General on making sure that the mistakes of the past never happen again. We don't have cases that actually run through the Hinton Lab. So I appreciate that the latest DA to do this is DA Rollins. Other DAs have already dismissed cases that involve Dukin and Farrakh in the Hinton Lab. DA Ryan took the significant step of actually petitioning the Supreme Judicial Court for global relief here. You know, I support all of these efforts. I think it's really important that we fix whatever wrongs there were and that we ensure that the integrity of these systems going forward. And, you know, to that end, I'm pleased my office co-chaired the Massachusetts Conviction Integrity Working Group recently, came out with a report. We did that with DA Ryan, with Mass Bar Association, with CPCS, the defenders and counsel, and Prisoners Legal Services. And, you know, we put out a report, actually a guide basically for prosecutors' offices on how to remedy and prevent wrongful convictions in Massachusetts. It's a start, but, you know, this is incredibly important for justice and for public confidence in our judicial system.
So WBUR has reported that your office is paying the legal fees of three former assistant attorneys general who face possible punishment for not turning over exculpatory evidence. We're still waiting to hear from the Board of Bar Overseers on their recommendation on any punishment for the three former assistant attorneys general. But if this goes to a lengthy appeals process, will your office continue to pay the legal bills?
Yes, and I'll tell you why. This is actually something that's done routinely. This conduct involves conduct by former employees of a former administration, not my administration. And basically, it involved, you know, how they handled certain cases related where work was done by Sonia Farak. I mentioned earlier the implications of the egregious crimes of Annie Dugan and Sonia Farak. And, you know, this is just another example of how this sort of spun out, right, in terms of its reach. But in any event, when there isn't any kind of lawsuit or investigation of a state employee, the state does do that representation. Here, these respondents were AGO employees. Our office was actually conflicted out of the representation because of the positions that we had taken. Nevertheless, they have a right to counsel, and they have a right to have those legal fees paid.
I know you're aware there is some pushback that this is not consistent with other precedents and some question about whether it's the right use of taxpayer money. Do you see that concern about the use of taxpayer money here, and how do you address that?
Not in this instance. I mean, this is appropriate. You know, I understand people's maybe concerns, the optics of it, but, you know, people have a right to counsel, and you know, it's just part of how these matters are handled. And, you know, I understand a concern being raised, but this is how things are handled and done. And again, it's people have a right to counsel.
So let's shift gears. Let's talk about the hate crime bill. You recently co-wrote an op-ed for the Boston Globe with State Senator Adam Hines and State Representative Tram Nguyen about the need for a new hate crime law. It was driven in part by the spike in recent anti-Asian American sentiments, but other violent race and nationality-based incidents in the Commonwealth in recent years, too. Why isn't what we currently have on the books enough? What would we accomplish with a new law that we can't accomplish now?
Well, it's thanks for the question. And, you know, I think this is legislation that I filed in the context of looking around at what's happening throughout the country, where we have seen a rise in hate crimes. We've seen a rise in white supremacy and extremism and the like. And I talked to my colleagues, law enforcement officials from around the country, about this topic regularly. In fact, the agenda this year, the initiative this year of the National AGs Association is on eradicating hate and addressing some of these issues. So, you know, I thought it was responsible for me to look in our own backyard. And it turns out our hate crimes laws haven't been updated in a long time. If you can believe it, gender was not included as a protected class for purposes of a hate crime. So we've changed that to include protection of women and of immigrants. As you know, immigrants have been subjected to any number of hate crimes. So, you know, that's important. We wanted to update and provide clearer definitions. We wanted to clarify who was protected. We wanted to define the elements of certain crimes and their penalties, because our experience has been is that it's been too amorphous and hard for both investigators, prosecutors, and judges to be able to prosecute or adjudicate these cases. And, you know, it's just important that we give the tools out there to ensure that we are holding perpetrators of hate crimes accountable. We also, of course, have to do the education, right, and the outreach. There's a whole lot we have to do as a society in terms of combating hate and hate-based violence. But when it comes to the tools actually available to an office like mine or other offices to prosecute a hate crime, we just felt it was important to update the laws so that they're actually workable and can be implemented.
Attorney General Healy, I know your schedule is tight. I just have a couple more important questions for you. Adrian Walker wrote in the Globe this week about a collegial relationship that you have with the Minnesota Attorney General, Keith Ellison. You sought some guidance for him about how to talk about the guilty verdict in the Chauvin trial. You know, you're on the enforcement side of the equation, and we have been facing hard truths as a country and a community about our criminal justice system. Over these years, have you changed how you see the system, your job in the system, and what do you think your obligation for reform is?
Well, you know, it's a great question, and you allude to my friendship with Attorney General Keith Ellison. He and his team did a wonderful job prosecuting Derek Chauvin. And, you know, I think, remember, I left private practice. I was a business litigator. I left private practice to become chief of the Civil Rights Division. So actually my path is as a civil rights lawyer enforcing civil rights laws. And yes, I oversee the Attorney General's office entirely now, but I think that for far too long, people have tried to suggest that we can't pursue racial justice and support law enforcement at the same time. Of course we can. I mean, right now we are going through a painful reckoning right now in our country, because for 400 years, systemic racism has permeated all realms of society, not just the criminal justice system, not just policing, but housing, employment, healthcare, transportation, you name it. So I think the discussions that we're having as a country right now, and they are hard, are incredibly important, you know? And so I feel people's pain, you know, I've witnessed it in the conversations that I've had with my team, with community members, the heartbreak of seeing the killings and the images on TV. It is important that we in law enforcement bring that accountability. The conversation I had with Keith, you know, was about the fact that this isn't really justice. I mean, the verdict was not justice. If there were justice, George Floyd would be alive today. But as he said to me, Maura, it's about accountability, and that is a step forward, right? One verdict is not a solution. We've got hard work to do, but I think he and I and others are engaged in that, and inviting all to that effort in law enforcement and outside of law enforcement. It is up to us to do something about it now. So I don't know that my lens has changed. What I do think has changed, though, particularly after this year, I think people have seen more starkly some of the racial disparities that exist. You look at COVID and the disproportionate number of Black and Brown residents here and across this country who've died. And you put that against the context of what we've seen in some of these killings by police officers. I mean, the time is now, and we have to seize this as community and as a country. And certainly those of us in positions like the one I hold, where we enforce the laws, including civil rights laws, you know, we're looking forward to really to doing that work. As hard as it is, we have to do that work. That includes implementing here in Massachusetts our recently passed State Police Reform Act. We're prioritizing racial equity in my office across all realms, whether it's tackling disparities in education or the environment or healthcare. And we're certainly urging the passage of the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act, a federal law that will give my office and other AGs clear statutory authority, the same authority that the U.S. Department of Justice has, to investigate patterns or practices of unconstitutional policing. But I ask people to continue to stay engaged, talk to one another, listen to one another. We need this. We need this moment. With this moment, we have to make something of this moment. It's been hundreds of years in the making, and we, for the sake of our country and our future, we have to take this opportunity and make things right.
All right, so last question. You have demurred on the question of whether you will run for governor, and I get that, but the Boston Herald has reported that you've got polling in the field. So I'm going to ask you the question a little differently. Are you contemplating a run for anything other than re-election as attorney general in the next cycle?
You know, at this point, I am really thoroughly involved in my work and continue to be. I love my job and the opportunity it gives me and the team to try to get out there and make a difference. So, You know, that's my mindset right now. I have enjoyed getting out, as I say, visiting vaccination sites, visiting food pantries, thanking healthcare workers, visiting small businesses, you know, all within recent weeks, just to sort of say thank you for everything you did this year, to let people know that the office is going to be there as an advocate to try to help in any number of ways at the state and federal level. And, you know, for me, it's a people business. That's the business we're in. And so, you know, I've really enjoyed having the chance to do that, because we were locked down for a long time. And, you know, I think also, you know, in my job, we got a lot of stuff on our plate as we move forward, right? We've got a lot of funding coming in, making sure, you know, if that's properly allocated, making sure that we deal with, you know, the lifting of eviction and foreclosure moratoriums, making sure that we figure out ways to take care of students and consumers and workers. You know, there's still a lot on our plate in the Attorney General's office. And, I just said, you know, I do these periodic live streams with my office. I just did one today with, you know, the whole office on. We get 600 folks, and you know, it's great to, even though it's gallery view, you know, and you it was great. You know, people were holding up their babies that they had during COVID. Awesome. Or their new puppies that they got during COVID, and you know, just a chance to come together and be there for each other. So I'll be glad when we're all back. And as I say, look forward to seeing you in person.
You too. And I do hope you'll come back and talk again soon. That's Massachusetts Attorney General Maura Healey. Thanks.
Great to be with you.